the plane was first designed. Dick Bissell had personally obtained permission from then-Chancellor Konrad Adenauer to use German soil for this secret spy operation. Simultaneously, in early June 1956, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, forerunner of the NASA space program, announced in Washington the beginning of a new high-altitude weather research program, using a new Lockheed U-2 airplane that was expected to fly above 10 miles high. The announcement was a fraud, claiming that the new U-2 would be charting weather patterns in advance of tomorrow's jet transports. Our U-2 detachment called itself the First Weather Reconnaissance Squadron, provisional. They were strange weather birds, hidden away in a remote corner of the Wiesbaden Air Base, guarded by CIA agents carrying submachine guns. And by the time these guys were setting up operations in Germany with four U-2s and six pilots, we at the Skunk Works were building 10 more airplanes that would supply three operational detachments, Detachment A in Germany, Detachment B in Turkey, and Detachment C in Japan. Once that first detachment was deployed, the secrecy lid clamped shut. All of us inside the Skunk Works felt in our bones that the overflights of Russia were imminent, but only Kelly was plugged in with the CIA. He would disappear for several days, and we all speculated that he was either on the scene in Germany, which was untrue, or being briefed in Washington by Mr. B, which was true, and actually shown the photos taken from the first flights, also true. The first Russian overflight occurred on July 4, 1956. A CIA pilot named Harvey Stockman flew over northern Poland into Belorussia and over Minsk, then turned left and headed to Leningrad. He was tracked on radar all the way, and dozens of Soviet interceptors tried in vain to reach him, but he made it back safely into Germany, having flown for nearly 9 hours. When I came to work after that holiday weekend, Kelly sent for several of us in the analytical section and briefed us in a somewhat limited fashion. "Well, boys, I got his first picture postcard. The first take is being processed right now. But goddammit, we were spotted almost as soon as we took off. I think we've badly underestimated their radar capabilities. We could tell from overhearing their ground chatter that they were way off in estimating our altitude, but we always figured they wouldn't even see us at 65,000 feet. And you know why? Because we gave them Lend-Lease early warning radar during World War II and presumed that, like us, they wouldn't do anything to improve it. Obviously they have. I want you guys to brainstorm what we can do to make us less visible or help us go even higher." The Soviets were launching half their damned air force to try to stop these flights, and the president was upset at how easily they were tracking the U-2. "Mr. B is trying to bunch these flights before Ike gets cold feet or the Russians get lucky," Kelly sighed. "The president has given us 10 good weather days for these missions. After that, who knows?" Other voices. Marty Knutson. I was the first pilot selected to fly in the U-2 program and made the third flight over the Soviet Union on the morning of July 8, 1956. I was a 26-year-old with 1,000 hours of fighter time who had almost died of disappointment the first time I saw the U-2. I looked in the cockpit and saw that the damn thing had a yoke or steering wheel. The last straw. Either you flew with a stick like a self-respecting fighter jock, or you were a crappy bomber driver, a goddamn disgrace, who steered with a yoke, like a damn truck driver at the steering wheel of a big rig. I wound up flying that U-2 for the CIA for the next 29 years. It was a bitch to land and easy to stall out, but I fell in love. I was just crazy enough to enjoy the danger. Now here I was flying over Russia, in a fragile little airplane with a wingspan as long as the damned Brooklyn Bridge, and below I could see 300 miles in every direction. This was enemy territory, big time. In those days especially, I had a very basic attitude about the Soviet Union. Man, it was an evil empire, a forbidding alien place, and I sure as hell didn't want to crash land in the middle of it. I had to pinch myself that I was actually flying over the Soviet Union. I began the day by eating a high-protein breakfast, steak and eggs, then put on the bulky pressure suit and the heavy helmet, and had to lie down in a contour chair for 2 hours before taking off and breathe pure oxygen. The object was to purge the nitrogen out of my system to avoid getting the bends if I had to come down quick from altitude. I knew from being briefed by the two other guys who flew these missions ahead of me to expect a lot of Soviet air activity. Those bastards tracked me from the minute I took off, which was an unpleasant surprise. We thought we would be invisible to their radar at such heights. No dice. Through my drift sight, I saw 15 Russian MiGs following me from about 15,000 feet below. The day before, Carmen Vito had followed the railroad tracks right into Moscow, and actually saw two MiGs collide and crash while attempting to climb to his altitude. Vito had a close call. The ground crew had put his poison cyanide pill in the wrong pocket. We were issued the pill in case of capture and torture and all that good stuff, but given the option whether to use it or not. But Carmen didn't know the cyanide was in the right breast pocket of his coveralls when he dropped in a fistful of lemon-flavored cough drops. The cyanide pill was supposed to be in an inside pocket. Vito felt his throat go dry as he approached Moscow for the first time. Who could blame him? So he fished in his pocket for a cough drop and grabbed the cyanide pill instead and popped it into his mouth. He started to suck on it. Luckily, he realized his mistake in a split second and spit it out in horror before it could take effect. Had he bit down, he would have died instantly and crashed right into Red Square. Just imagine the international uproar. I kept my cyanide pill in an inside pocket and prayed that I would not have an engine flameout. The flameout meant I had a pack of goddamn problems on my hands that might well land me in a Russian morgue or in some goddamn gulag. I was all pumped up, like flying combat in Korea. Nothing in the cockpit was automated back then. We had to fly a precise line at 70,000 feet, looking through the drift sight and using maps. I'd compare what I was seeing through the sight to what the map showed. Pretty damned primitive, like 1930s flying by the seat of the pants. But we all grew very skilled at it. I flew over Leningrad, and it blew my mind because Leningrad was my target as an SAC pilot, and I spent 2 years training with maps and films, and here I was, coming in from the same direction as in the SAC battle plan, looking down on it through my sights. Only this time I was lining up for photos, not a bomb drop. It was a crystal clear day, and about 20 minutes out of Leningrad, I hit pay dirt. This was exactly what the President of the United States was waiting to see. I flew right over a bomber base called Engels Airfield, and there, lined up and waiting for my cameras, were 30 Bison bombers. This would prove the worst, I thought, because the powers that be, back in Washington, feared that we were facing a huge bomber gap. I proved the gap, or so I thought. As it turned out, my pictures were rushed by Alan Dulles to the Oval Office. For several weeks, there was real consternation. But then the results of other flights began coming in, and my 30 Bisons were the only ones spotted in that whole massive goddamn country. So our people began to relax a little, and we turned our attention to their missile production. I flew hundreds of missions for the agency after that. But that moment over Engels Airfield I considered the most important of any ride I took. I was overflying the most secretive society on the face of the earth, about whom we knew little. And here, a raid below with no place to hide from my lens was a big chunk of their air power. I remember mumbling, "Holy shit," as those cameras whirred. I knew that this was an espionage coup second to none in importance and significance. After those first flights, the Russians went all out to stop the U-2. The Russian ambassador delivered a formal protest to the State Department, and the Kremlin privately threatened the Germans to either close us down or face a rocket attack on the base. KGB agents parked in big black cars just outside the fence, watching us take off and land. So we moved to a base in southern Turkey. Most of these Turkish flights monitored Soviet missile test sites on their southern border. Sputnik went up October 1957, the Russians putting the first object into space orbit. And they bragged about their ICBM capabilities to reach anywhere in the U.S., although they had no test launches from May 1958 to the following February. Ike was being roasted alive by the press for letting them get the jump on us. We covered Tyuratam, their missile test facility, nuclear test sites, and Kupustin Yar, their operational center for ABMs. I flew on the eastern side of the Urals to observe their missile test launches. The CIA had spies on the ground who tipped us off whenever there would be a missile test. We usually had one day's notice to get ready and needed the president's approval to monitor the shot. By the fall of 1959, they were test-firing one missile a week. I made one or two of those observation flights, and they were truly spectacular. I flew in the dead of night over some of the most remote terrain in the world. No lights down there. On a moonless night, it was like flying through an ocean of ink. I flew with a big camera perched on my lap. The camera was handheld and had special film that could determine from the flame shooting from the rocket's nozzle what kind of fuel they were using, and even how they were making their rockets. The U-2 also had special sniffers installed on the outside fuselage that would pick up chemical traces in the air after the firing for analysis back in Washington. Suddenly the sky lit up, and that big rocket roared off the pad. I snapped away taking pictures of that plume for a matter of seconds before it disappeared into space. The Russians never even knew I was up there. But the most exciting mission I ever flew was out of a small landing field at Peshawar in Pakistan, where we had a support unit set up in late 1958. The flight was so long range that there was no way for me to get back to the base. My main target was in Kazakhstan, a radar and missile test center, then onto a nuclear test site near Semipalatinsk, and finally an overflight of a main ICBM launch test facility. By then, I would have stretched the airplane's range to the limit and would be nearly out of gas. The plan called for me to glide over the Urals to save fuel and land at a tiny World War II airstrip near Zahedan in Iran, right in the triangle where Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan converge. The agency would send in a C-130 with agents armed with grenades and Tommy guns to secure the base from mountain bandits who controlled that territory. If I made it across the border and saw a cloud of black smoke, it meant that the field was being attacked by the bandits. If that happened, I was supposed to eject and bail out. I crossed the Russian border with only 100 gallons of fuel remaining. Really getting hairy. I didn't see any smoke, so I came in and landed with less than 20 gallons left in the tank. One of the agents had a six-pack of beer icing. They had an antenna set up and were supposed to send a coded message that I was safe. One of the guys came to me and said, "Our equipment is down. I know you're a ham operator. Do you, by any chance, know Morse code?" I'm sitting there under a blazing sun, still in my pressure suit, sipping a beer in one hand, and with the other tapping out the dots and dashes. About the start of 1959, we began seeing ominous activities going on inside Russia. Around their strategic bases were strange Star of David patterns. We learned quickly enough that that meant the construction of ground-to-air missile sites. We now had orders that if we saw any new Star of David patterns, we were to deviate from the flight plan and go film them. These first SAMs couldn't reach us. The optimum use of their surface controls was lower, 55,000 feet, to be used against our bombers. But we figured we were flying on borrowed time. Sooner or later, one of us would get nailed. I knew for sure it would be the other guy. They tried to stop us by trying to ram us with their fighters like a ballistic missile. They stripped down some of their MiG-21s and flew straight up at top speed, arcing up to 68,000 feet before flaming out and falling back toward Earth. Presumably, they got a relight down around 35,000 feet. I'm sure they lost some airplanes and pilots playing kamikaze missile. It was crazy. But it showed how angry and desperate they were becoming. By the winter of 1960, we were getting intelligence briefings warning us about improvements in Soviet tracking and SAM capability. Their new SA-2 missile was an improved version of what they previously had, capable of reaching us and equipped with a powerful warhead that could be lethal if exploded within 400 feet of an airplane. We gave the SA-2 a wide berth whenever possible. I have to admit, we were all getting plenty worried. We had long since installed ejection seats. That was one item of added weight no one in his right mind would do without. Ben Rich. The CIA codenamed the project Rainbow. The orders came directly from the Oval Office and had the highest priority. Every one of Kelly's engineers and designers was put to work. The object? significantly lower the U-2's radar signature, or face a presidential cancellation of the entire program. These orders arrived just before the new year in 1956, after only 7 or 8 overflights of the Soviet Union. The Russians were using diplomatic channels to scream at us. They were too embarrassed by their own ineptitude in being able to stop the overflights to make their threats public. But that did not make those threats less ominous. So the heat was on to find ways to reduce the airplane's radar signature from approximately that of a Fifth Avenue bus to the size of a 2-door coupe. But the U-2's big tail, wings, and large inlets designed for its lift and thrust got in the way, acting like a circus spotlight on hostile radar scopes. Kelly flew to Cambridge, Massachusetts, seeking advice from a high-powered scientific group doing research on anti-radar technology. He brought back with him 2 of their best radar experts, Dr. Frank Rogers and Ed Purcell, to help us brainstorm. I was involved analyzing various composites and paints that might be tried to absorb radar energy without adding too much weight to the airplane. The U-2 was painted a dull black to prevent it from glinting in the sun. We wanted to make it as difficult as possible to achieve human detection from the ground or from below in an interceptor trying to reach it. And we began experimenting with chromic paint that changed from different shades of blue to black at different temperatures, like a chameleon. But paint added more weight than deception, as did the idea of painting the U-2 with polka dots to break up the silhouette against the sky. As for fooling radar, Rogers and Purcell suggested a radical fix, stringing piano wire of various dipole lengths along the entire fuselage, in the hope of scattering as much radar energy in as many frequencies as possible in every direction. The wires made the U-2 draggy, and we lost 7,000 feet in altitude. The next thing we tried was something called a Salisbury screen, a metallic grid applied to the airplane's undercarriage in the hope of deflecting incoming radar beams, but it worked only at some frequencies and altitudes and not at others. Kelly thought it was more practical to try special iron ferrite paints that would absorb a radar ping rather than bounce it back to the sender. The paints were moderately effective but inhibited heat dissipation through the airframe's outer skin, and we experienced overheating engine problems. But the paint lowered the radar cross-section by 1 order of magnitude, so we decided to give it a try. We called these specially painted planes Dirty Birds, and shipped the first one out for flight testing in April 1957. Our test pilot, Bob Seeker, took the U-2 up to over 70,000 feet and suddenly radioed that he was experiencing rapid airframe heat buildup. Moments later, his engine blew out, and the faceplate blew off Bob's oxygen mask as his pressure suit instantly inflated. The U-2 dove straight down and crashed. It took us 3 days to locate the wreckage and Bob's body. An autopsy revealed that above 70,000 feet he had suffered acute hypoxia and lost consciousness in only 10 seconds. The culprit that killed him was a defective faceplate clasp that cost 50 cents. The CIA was so desperate to buy time for these Soviet overflights that Bissell got Kelly to sequester 4 of our test flight engineers and have them write a bogus flight manual for a U-2 twice as heavy as ours, and with a maximum altitude of only 50,000 feet that carried only scientific weather gear in its bay. The manual included phony instrument panel photos with altered markings for speed, altitude, and load factor limits. 4 copies were produced and then artificially aged with grease, coffee stains, and cigarette burns. How or if the agency got them into Soviet hands, only Mr. B knew, and he never told. Other Voices. James Sherboneau. In July 1957, a cargo plane brought the first so-called Dirty Bird to our base in Turkey. It was covered with a plastic material and had 2 sets of piano wires strung from either side of its nose to a set of poles sticking out of the wings. The wires were to scatter radar beams while the paint was to absorb other frequencies. But I wasn't thrilled. Part of my big paycheck was compensation for high-risk missions in a semi-experimental airplane, but I had never before risked flying an airplane wired like a guitar. The Skunk Works engineer who flew out with the Dirty Bird admitted that its extra weight would cost us altitude and 3,000 miles in diminished range. On July 7, 1956, I flew the Dirty Bird on an operational test of the whole Soviet defense net along the Black Sea, flying inside 12 miles of the coastline. The flight lasted 8 hours, and I carried an array of special recording devices while deliberately trying to provoke responses from Soviet air defense along its entire southern flank. The plan was to see if they could detect our Dirty Bird. All in all, the coatings and wire worked well, but analysis of my recordings indicated that the bad guys were homing in on my cockpit and tailpipe, neither of which had been treated. As it turned out, my most incredible overflight occurred only 2 weeks later in a mission specially cleared by President Eisenhower and involving a Dirty Bird. I took off in total secrecy from a field in Pakistan, flying a Dirty Bird for a flight deep inside Russia to photograph a missile site believed to be readying intercontinental missile tests. Because of the added dirty weight, I could top out at only 58,000 feet. The missile site was a 3-hour trip, but about 75 minutes into the mission, I looked through my drift sight and saw a startling sight, the familiar circular graded contours that I had seen marking our own nuclear test site at Yucca Flats. My heart jumped. Could it really be? We had no idea that this test site even existed. I brought my drift sight up to its maximum 4-power magnification and focused on a large tower. I felt a chilling terror. That tower held a large object at the top, and there were signs of activity around a huge blockhouse about 2 miles away. And then a paralyzing thought slammed me. What if those bastards were getting set to let that nuclear weapon blow just as I was directly overhead? And in fact, that crazy thought took hold, and I began to sweat and hyperventilate in panic. "Wait, goddammit, wait, will you? Let me pass, and then light your fire," I was shouting into my faceplate. I carried a 3-camera system, one pointing straight down, and the other two out at 45-degree angles, so that each picture would overlap and provide a stereographic photo interpretation. I threw a switch and the cameras began to whir in sequence. It seemed to take an eternity for my airplane to cross directly over that tower. My heart was pounding in my throat. I just knew I was going to be evaporated in the next seconds. 5 minutes later, I was clear of the nuclear test site, laughing at myself for being so chicken. 3 hours later, I was over the city of Omsk in central Russia, photographing a military-industrial complex of interest to SAC as a potential target. Then I turned east to head for the missile test site, my principal target for the mission. I photographed the site, which bore evidence of a very recent test firing, then headed back to Pakistan. I looked through the drift site at the vastness of central Russia, a vastness almost unimaginable that made me feel achingly lost and alone. There were no telltale contrails of MiGs trying to get me, so I had to conclude that the Skunk Works had worked its magic and kept me hidden from the bad guy's radar. If true, that meant that no one on Earth knew where I was at that particular moment, because I was also out of range of U.S. listening posts. Suddenly, I became alert. My engine started making rough noises, but I knew from long experience that the roughness of an engine is in direct proportion to how far a pilot still has to go before he makes it safely across a hostile border. 20 minutes later, I saw the shimmering snowy peak of the awesome mountain called K2, illuminated against a dark blue sky. K2 was my beacon back to Pakistan, and a hot shower and sleep. And I calculated it was an hour away, about 450 miles before I crossed the border. I was now 8 hours plus into the mission, and I became aware of the need to urinate. I cursed myself for forgetting to avoid any liquids the night before the flight, something I tried always to do because I was never able to pee out of my pressure suit. To do so, I had to unwork 3 layers and then pee uphill into a nozzle arrangement. I just couldn't. But I began to ache, real pain, like knife thrusts down there. I was exhausted and in agony. I tried to pee into the nozzle. I tried to wet my pants, but I was having spasms and nothing came out. It was so bad I could barely focus my eyes, and K2's magnificent granite towers slipped by directly below and I barely noticed, or cared a damn. By the time I made my landing approach, the pain was searing to the point where I almost landed short of the field and crashed into a forest. I barely remember the mechanic opening my canopy at the top of his ladder and me pushing him aside like a maniac and vaulting down that ladder in a flash. Moments later, not heeding privacy, I set a new world record on that tarmac. I expected to be received as a hero for having uncovered a Soviet nuclear test site with a bomb in the tower. Instead, the team who had debriefed me scoffed incredulously. "There is no atomic test facility in that part of Central Russia," one debriefer told me. But they passed on my observation by special wire to Washington, while another team began processing my film. CIA headquarters responded by coded cable in less than an hour. Their communication was stern, halfway between a personal rebuke and an official reprimand. My credibility was zero back home. But the next day over lunch, John Parangoski, the senior CIA agent in charge of our operation, took me aside with a sheepish grin. "Apologies, Jim. Collateral intelligence sources just reported that a nuclear bomb was detonated from that tower less than 2 hours after you flew over it." Ben Rich. During the final winter of the U-2 overflights of Russia, Kelly Johnson came back from a visit to CIA headquarters looking profoundly gloomy. He couldn't believe how easily the Russians were tracking our overflights, and knew it was only a matter of time before their ground-to-air missile defenses caught up with their prowess in radar development and blew us out of the sky. "Putting fixes on this airplane won't do any good. We need a fresh piece of paper," Kelly told a group of us. His mind was already churning, thinking about the U-2's successor that could survive flying above Moscow. He had asked our ace mathematician Bill Schroeder to predict how long it would take the Soviets to bring down a U-2 with their latest missile system. Schroeder gave the U-2 less than a year. One of our engineers came back from a quick-fix visit to the secret U-2 base in Turkey to say that the morale among the pilots was sagging. The guys were worried about the new SA-2 missile sites under construction around the Soviet Union's main target areas. The president was very aware of the growing dangers and had cut back sharply on authorizing U-2 missions. And the trip our engineer made to Turkey indicated the growing concerns about pilot safety. He was on hand to supervise a new black box installed into the U-2's tail section to electronically counter incoming radar beams and scatter them away. In the jargon of the trade, the box was called an ECM, electronic countermeasure, and would hopefully prevent a missile fired at a U-2 from locking on. The word Kelly received from Dick Bissell was that the intelligence community was pushing hard for at least one more overflight over Tyuratom, the big Russian missile test center deep in the Urals, since a recent flight had revealed significant advances toward development of their first operational intercontinental missile. Eisenhower was ready to approve the follow-up flight, but the State Department heard about it, and Secretary of State Christian Herter was strongly opposed. Herter had replaced John Foster Dulles, who had died of cancer earlier in the year, and was worried that any overflight might upset the delicate planning that had revolved around a summit in Paris between Ike and Khrushchev, scheduled to start on May 14th. Bissell told Kelly that Alan Dulles had wrested one final flight out of the president, provided it took place 2 weeks before the Paris summit. The target date was May 1, 1960, the Soviet May Day, akin to our 4th of July. "We hoped to catch them with their defenses down, with only skeleton crews at work." As it turned out, our black box and the route of the mission finally selected would seal the fate of that tragic last flight. Ike had signed off on two mission options and left the final decision to the CIA. The choices were missions codenamed Time Step, which would overfly certain key nuclear and missile test sites, and Grand Slam, a marathon 9-hour mission from Pakistan clear across Russia to land at a base in Bodø, Norway. The heart of Grand Slam was overflying Tyuratom, then heading south to photograph the huge military-industrial complexes at Sverdlovsk and Plesetsk. All were heavily defended. The two plans were sent for review to the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Nathan Twining, who quickly spotted a flaw in the Grand Slam mission and called Allen Dulles to personally urge changes. Twining had noticed that the proposed mission repeated the exact route into Sverdlovsk from the south, used less than a month earlier by U-2 pilot Marty Knudsen. Allen, if you come in that way again, they'll know exactly where you are heading and will just be lying in wait. You'll get nailed. Dulles obviously didn't agree. He personally chose Grand Slam with no changes. Because the mission would be so demanding and long, covering 3,700 miles from Pakistan to Norway, the agency chose its most experienced pilot and the best navigator of the group, 34-year-old Francis Gary Powers. The pilot had 27 U-2 missions logged, including several marathon-length flights across the eastern Mediterranean in 1956, to gather intelligence on the movements of British and French warships participating with Israel in attacking Egypt during the Suez Crisis. Powers took off at dawn from Peshawar, Pakistan, on Sunday, May 1, 1960. Flying across the Soviet border for the first time from Pakistan was another way to catch the Russians napping. And for the first 3 hours into the flight, the plan worked perfectly. He flew over to Tyuratam without difficulty, then changed course and headed south towards Sverdlovsk, on the same flight plan as Knudsen's only weeks earlier. As he approached the Sverdlovsk complex, Powers was suddenly blinded by a brilliant orange flash and felt an explosion from behind. His right wing dropped and he began pitching down. His instincts told him his tail had been hit as the airplane began a steep nosedive. In horror, he saw his wings rip off. His pressure suit inflated, squeezing him in a vice-like grip, and his faceplate began to frost. He glanced at the altimeter, saw he was at 34,000 feet and falling fast, and almost panicked, realizing he was pinned by the centrifugal force up against the instrument panel. If he hit the ejection lever, he'd be blasted out of the cabin, while leaving both his pinned legs behind. He struggled to push back in his seat and manually opened the canopy. He unhitched his safety harness, and as the wingless fuselage spun upside down, Francis Gary Powers fell free. As his chute opened, Powers was startled to see another chute opening in the distance. Whatever hit him had also hit a Soviet pilot as well. He landed hard in a farmer's field. Several villagers came running to him. They weren't unfriendly and had no idea he was an American because he was too stunned to even say a word, while they conversed among themselves excitedly. They finally helped him to a truck and drove him off. He would later learn they were driving him to the local airport, assuming he was a Russian pilot and not knowing what else to do with him. At some point, though, the truck was stopped by the militia. The police grabbed Powers and took him away. It would later be determined that a Soviet missile battery had launched in shotgun fashion 14 SA-2s at the approaching U-2, an indication that they were waiting for his arrival. One missile had knocked down a Russian fighter trying to intercept Powers, and the shockwaves from the exploding missiles had knocked off the U-2's tail. Kelly received the call at home well after midnight, and he grimly arrived at the Skunk Works that Monday morning and assembled a group of us. "We got nailed over Sverdlovsk by an SA-2. That's that. We're dead." It was the first time in history that a ground-to-air missile had shot down an airplane, and all of us assumed, knowing how fragile the U-2 was and at the height it was probably flying when it was hit, that the pilot had been killed. The CIA immediately had NASA launch a pre-planned cover story that one of its weather research planes flying out of Turkey had strayed off course and was missing after the pilot indicated he was having oxygen problems. KG Khrushchev waited for Eisenhower to arrive in Paris for the summit before announcing that the Russians had shot down a U-2 spy plane. The administration called that a fantastic allegation. Eisenhower denied spy flights. And then, on the eve of the summit, Khrushchev announced that the pilot had been captured and confessed his spy mission. The pilot was named Francis Gary Powers. Eisenhower was humiliated and forced to admit the U-2 spy operation, which he said was justified since Khrushchev had recently turned down his open skies proposal. To mollify the Russians and save the summit, Ike announced we would end the flights, which he had privately done anyway. But when Khrushchev demanded an apology, the summit collapsed and Eisenhower went back home. Inside the Skunk Works, we were no less stunned that Powers had survived than the CIA and the White House. The agency was livid at Powers for not dying in the hit or taking his own life, even though using the poison needle that had replaced the cyanide pill in a pilot's kit was entirely optional. But some of the more macho patriots around the Skunk Works agreed with their opposite numbers, thundering around at the CIA that Powers was a damn traitor for not self-destructing. And they meant it. Because he was chicken, the president endured a terrible international humiliation. Powers' survival also embarrassed Dulles and Bissell, who had assured the president, presumably in good faith, that not much would be left of a U-2 or a pilot if shot down by a missile. Powers was also faulted for not pulling a 70-second delayed explosive charge before bailing out that would have destroyed the film and cameras and kept them out of the hands of the KGB. There was little sympathy for Powers, who was kept incommunicado inside the notorious Lubyanka prison for months before enduring a propaganda show trial that heaped embarrassment on the agency and the administration for more than 3 weeks. Powers was sentenced harshly to 10 years at hard labor and served nearly 2 years before being exchanged in February 1962 for the captured Russian master spy Rudolf Abel, a decision that only enraged many at the CIA even more. "That's like trading Mickey Mantle for a goddamn bullpen catcher," one of the agency guys exploded when hearing the news. Had Powers killed himself or not survived the missile hit, he would have come home a hero in a flag-draped wooden box. But coming home haggard and alive, he was greeted like a traitor and was whisked off in great secrecy to a CIA safe house in Virginia to be grilled unmercifully for days about his experiences over and inside Russia. Kelly was summoned to the debriefing to hear the part about the shootdown and was satisfied that Powers was telling the truth. Kelly had long ago analyzed photographs of the U-2 wreckage released by the Russians and reported to Bissell his conviction that the airplane had been hit from the rear. "It looks like they knocked off his tail." At the debriefing, Powers confirmed that fact. Kelly felt sorry for the guy and offered him a job as a U-2 flight test engineer at the Skunk Works. He gratefully accepted and worked for us for 8 years until the mid-1970s, when he went to work for a local TV station as a helicopter traffic reporter. He was killed in a helicopter crash on August 1, 1977. 10 years later, the Air Force awarded the former captain a posthumous Distinguished Flying Cross, a medal well-earned, if sadly late in arriving. Kelly long suspected that the electronic countermeasure black box we installed on the tail section of Powers' U-2 may have acted in an opposite way from the one we intended. The box was codenamed Granger, and we provided the frequencies used to jam and confuse the enemy missile. These were the same frequencies the Russians used on their defensive radar. But it was possible that the Russians had changed these frequencies by the time we incorporated them into our missile spoofer, so that the incoming missile's seeker head was on the same frequency as the beams transmitted off our tail and acted as a homing device. A few years later, a similar black box was installed in the tails of CIA U-2s piloted by Taiwanese flying highly dangerous missions over the Chinese mainland. One day, 3 of 4 U-2s were shot down, and the sole survivor told CIA debriefers that he was amazed to be alive because he forgot to turn on his black box. To Kelly, that clinched the case. But we'll never really know. Other Voices. Richard Helms, director of the CIA from 1966 to 1973. The U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union provided us with the greatest intelligence breakthrough of the 20th century. For the first time, American policymakers had accurate, credible information on Soviet strategic assets. We could evaluate in real time the other side's strengths and weaknesses, keep current on their state of preparedness, their research and development, their priorities in defense spending, the state of their infrastructure, and the disposition of their most important military units. It was as if the scales had been lifted from our eyes, and we could now see with clarity exactly what it was we were up against. It really was as if we in the intelligence community had cataracts removed, because previous to those splendid U-2 missions, our ability to pierce the Iron Curtain was uncertain, and the results were often murky. We were forced to use defector information and other unreliable means to sift for clues about what the other side was up to. Given how little solid information actually filtered out to the West, we did a credible job, but the U-2's cameras leapfrogged us into another dimension altogether. For example, those overflights eliminated almost entirely the ability of the Kremlin ever to launch a surprise preemptive strike against the West. There was no way they could secretly prepare for war without our cameras revealing the size and scope of those activities. Building the U-2 was absolutely the smartest decision ever made by the CIA. It was the greatest bargain and the greatest triumph of the Cold War. And that airplane is still flying and is still tremendously effective. In my opinion, the national security demands that we keep supplying new generations of surveillance aircraft to our policymakers. There is no way to replace the vital data provided by piloted airplanes. Satellites lack the flexibility and the immediacy that only a spy plane like the U-2 can provide. No president or intelligence agency should have to operate with only one eye in such an uncertain and dangerous world. Richard Bissell. I have no doubt that the U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union made up the most important intelligence-gathering operation ever launched by the West. Until those flights, our side had to be content with some ingenious analysis on our part about their nuclear program. For instance, that later U-2 overflights would confirm as being remarkably correct. We were much less correct about their missile development because we had assumed, quite incorrectly, that they would continue to develop liquid-fuel missiles, while very secretly they dropped that concept and embarked on more sophisticated, solid-state missiles. That caught us by surprise and generated the so-called missile gap. There was also a profound worry about the size of their long-range bomber fleet. President Eisenhower told Allen Dulles that obtaining a hard count of their bombers was the urgent priority of the intelligence community. And by the time Allen chose me to head the U-2 project, the president told me that he regarded hard intelligence on Russian bombers as the number one item on his national security agenda. He told me that the minute I flashed the signal to him that Kelly Johnson was ready to deliver that airplane, he was ready to give me permission to start those flights. I told the president that we would probably have 2 years before the Russians would find a way to bring us down. As it turned out, we had a fruitful 4 years. The first flights I decided to bunch. My reasoning was that the first would be the safest, catching them by surprise, so we'd overfly all the highest priority targets. The first flight was to be over Leningrad, picking up important missile test sites and air bases along the route, then fly the length of the Baltic coast. I stopped by Allen Dulles' office and told him, "Well, we have an Oval Office green light, and we're off and running." When I told him the flight plan, he turned deathly pale. A few hours later, I was able to inform him that all went well. The next day, we scheduled 2 separate flights, one into the Ukraine and the other well north of that. We were looking for military airfields, our primary target. Only in later months did the location of hardened missile silos take precedence. It took us 4 days to get our hands on the photographs from that first mission. I remember vividly standing around a long table with Dulles next to me, both of us chuckling with amazement at the clarity of those incredible black-and-white photos. From 70,000 feet, you could not only count the airplanes lined up at ramps, but tell what they were without a magnifying glass. We were astounded. We had finally pried open the oyster shell of Russian secrecy and discovered a giant pearl. Allen rushed with the first samples over to the Oval Office. He told me that Eisenhower was so excited, he spread out the entire batch on the floor, and he and Allen viewed the photos like two kids running a model train. We never knew what we'd find from one mission to the next. Every airfield discovered increased our knowledge dramatically. On one flight, a pilot saw railroad track in the middle of nowhere and followed it, and brought back stunning pictures of a Soviet missile launcher at a site we never knew existed. Many other photos were confirmations of locations of important military bases that we had received from our spy network on the inside. We would get a tip about a new plant somewhere, but the informant was uncertain about whether they were manufacturing tanks or missiles, so we would schedule a look. Our first missions out of Pakistan were staged so that we could overfly Central Siberia and observe the Trans-Siberian Railroad, mainly because we had very sketchy inferential information that atomic facilities were being built there. We brought back very revealing photos indicating that a nuclear test facility was nearly completed on the site. After only 4 or 5 flights, our analysts were able to make much firmer estimates of the Soviet bomber strength by types. We had a count on how many planes of each type were photographed sitting out on their ramps. Of course, it was not watertight because airplanes seldom stayed put at one base or another, and it was hard to tell if we were counting the same airplanes seen at Base A that now appeared at Base B, or if these were additional ones. But the accumulated weight of evidence from these flights caused the President of the United States to draw in a deep breath, smile, and relax a bit. I was able to assure him that the so-called bomber gap seemed to be non-existent. By 6 months into the overflights, we turned our attention to their missile development. We found big research and development bases at the head of the Caspian Sea and just east of the Volga, and saw hard evidence of a number of experimental launches that had taken place there. We found a big radar installation at Sari Sagan between Turkestan and Siberia, and also a downrange site under construction near there, so we began to monitor this particular section very closely. Our estimates of their SAM missiles was that they could reach the altitude of the U-2, but that their surface controls were effective only up to 55,000 feet, and any higher than that they couldn't control a missile and bring it home for a kill against our spy plane. But the very unpleasant surprise was the ease with which they tracked every single one of our flights, almost from takeoff. Yet, until the Powers flight, they had never come close to hitting us. On one night flight out of Turkey, they had actually scrambled 57 fighters against one U-2, and on many occasions they were flying squadrons 15,000 feet underneath the U-2, trying to block the view. Kelly Johnson called that aluminum clouds. After the first few flights they tracked, they could infer the U-2's range, speed, altitude, and radar cross-section. So they knew all the important essentials about the airplane, which we cloaked under the deepest secrecy. Ironically, the two governments, in their abiding hostility, were collaborating to keep these flights secret from the public, because if they were ever revealed, the Russians would have to present us with an ultimatum and admit that they were impotent in stopping these flights over their territory. It must have been terribly upsetting inside the Kremlin knowing that the enemy could overfly with impunity. So I was constantly pressing Eisenhower for more flights, and he was constantly resisting me. I had to go to the mat on nearly every authorization because he was following the advice of the other Dulles brother, John Foster, our Secretary of State, who was wringing his hands over the spy flights right from the beginning. We flew fewer than 30 missions over those 4 years, but each of them was a remarkable success. We accumulated about 1,200,000 feet of film, a strip almost 250 miles long that covered more than 1 million square miles of the Soviet Union. The flights provided vital data on the Soviet atomic energy program, their development of fissionable materials, their weapons development and testing, and the location and size of their nuclear stockpile. It also gave us precise information on the location of their air defense systems, air bases and missile sites, submarine pens and naval installations, their order of battle, operational techniques and transportation and communications networks. By the Pentagon's own estimate, 90% of all hard data on Soviet military development came directly from the cameras on board the U-2. As early as 3 years before Powers was shot down, I flew out to Burbank with my deputy, Colonel Jack Gibbs, to meet with Kelly about the future. We estimated that the U-2 was operating on borrowed time after the 2-year mark. I said to Kelly, "We've got to begin now to design a successor." He told me he had already begun thinking about a liquid hydrogen-powered airplane, and was looking at ways to make his own liquid hydrogen fuel and build his own tank farm. A hydrogen-powered airplane was certainly ambitious, and in those days, Kelly seemed entirely capable of moving the world. 8. Blowing up Burbank. In the early winter of 1956, Kelly sent for me, and I walked down the hall to his office with my heart in my throat. I feared he was sending me back to the main plant with a handshake and goodbye. "Close the door," he said. I sat down opposite his desk like a condemned man, sensing the verdict. "Rich," he asked, "what do you know about cryogenics?" I shrugged. "Not much since college chemistry days." "I want you to read up thoroughly on all those exotic fuels, especially on liquid hydrogen, and then get back to me and we'll talk some more. Keep your damn mouth shut about this. Tell no one." When Kelly had tapped me for this assignment, the first thing I had done was to check the reference to liquid hydrogen in my copy of Mark's Mechanical Engineering Handbook, The Engineer's Bible, which told me what I already thought I knew. Liquid hydrogen had no real practical application because it was so dangerous to store and handle. It was a mere laboratory curiosity. I read that definition to Kelly Johnson and told him that I happened to agree. Kelly's face reddened. A storm was rising. "God damn it, Rich, I don't care what in hell that book says or what you happen to think. Liquid hydrogen is the same as steam. What is steam? Condensed water. Hydrogen plus oxygen produces water. That's all that liquid hydrogen really is. Now get out there and do the job for me." Over the next few weeks, I was living a boyhood fantasy and traveling around the country pretending to be a secret agent, using my Skunk Works alias of Ben Dover in the best traditions of trench-coated operatives. Kelly had warned me not to reveal that I worked at the Skunk Works to anyone I visited. I pretended to be a self-employed thermodynamicist, trying to learn as much as I could about liquid hydrogen for an investment group studying the possibilities of a hydrogen airplane engine. I was consulting with hydrogen experts around the country to find out how we could make our own liquid hydrogen safely and cheaply in large batches to fuel Kelly's latest dream. He was thinking about building a liquid hydrogen-powered spy plane as the successor to the U-2, giving us 20 times the thrust and power of a conventionally powered airplane. We'd be practically a space vehicle, whisking above 100,000 feet across the sky at more than twice the speed of sound. The entire Russian defense system would fall into a state of catatonic disbelief, mistaking us for a streaking comet. "I want answers, not excuses about why we can't do this," Kelly told me and shoved me out the door. Which is why I showed up as Mr. Ben Dover at Boulder, Colorado, where the U.S. Bureau of Standards maintained a cryogenic laboratory under the direction of Dr. Russell Scott, recognized as the world's expert on handling and storing liquid hydrogen. When I told him I wanted to learn how to handle liquid hydrogen in large amounts, like maybe running my own tank farm, the blood drained from Scott's face. "Mr. Dover," he said, "this stuff is volatile. One tank car could blow up an entire shopping mall. Do you have any notion of the risks?" My fact-finding took me into the dark and gloomy basement of the chemistry building at Berkeley, where Nobel laureate William Giauch held forth from a reinforced basement bunker, doing his prize-winning experiments on low-temperature research. I couldn't help noticing some holes punched in the walls courtesy of errant handling of small teacup amounts of liquid hydrogen by student lab assistants. "Handle with extreme care, Mr. Dover," Professor Giauch warned me. "That's why they keep me stashed away in this dungeon." When I told him that I wanted to learn how to make liquid hydrogen and store it in the hundreds of gallons, the professor shook his head solemnly. "With all due respect, sir, I think you've got a screw loose." I wanted to protest. "Not me, Prof, but that lunatic I work for." Actually, the idea of using hydrogen as a propellant had been kicking around since the end of World War II, primarily to fuel rocket engines, simply because its volatility created tremendous thrust. But Kelly wasn't thinking of a rocket engine. He wanted a conventional jet engine fueled by liquid hydrogen that could cruise for hours above Mach 2. Rocket engines were indeed like comets, blazing into the sky for a minute or two before extinguishing. As a hard-nosed businessman, Kelly was not about to commit to building such an airplane, unless he felt assured that we could produce sufficient supplies of fuel and learn how to handle it safely. So when I returned to Burbank armed with blueprints and technical manuals, Kelly smiled upon me benevolently and told me I was in charge of building our own hydrogen liquefaction plant. He sent me to a remote corner in the Lockheed complex, which had been during World War II a communal air raid shelter for hundreds of workers in the nearby B-17 bomber factory. Since then, it had been used to store bombs and bullets for our flight test division. It had 8-foot-thick walls and underground bunkers, and was, I noticed, as far away as he could get from us, in case something went wrong and we blew up. "Here's what I want," he told me. "I want to show the blue suitors that working with liquid hydrogen is not so risky once you attain experience handling it. I want to prove that a damned Air Force airman can handle it as well as a Ben Rich." The reason he was mentioning the Air Force was that the CIA had quickly rejected the idea of building a hydrogen airplane as the successor to the U-2. Bissell had had his own beam counters estimate the development costs, which were in the $100 million range, too costly for the agency's secret contingency funding, which bypassed the usual congressional appropriations committees. Even the CIA would find $100 million hard to hide. The Air Force, smarting for having to play a passive role in the U-2 Russian overflight operation, was receptive. The hydrogen airplane would put the blue suitors in the driver's seat for the next round of spy flights. Kelly had a promising preliminary discussion about the concept with the top Air Force brass involved with planning and development. They were eager to work with Kelly Johnson on just about anything involving Soviet overflight operations and decided to fund a feasibility study and begin the process of selecting a manufacturer to build a hydrogen-fueled engine. I was a key player in the feasibility study. I had to prove that the fuel was safe and practical to produce in large batches. Kelly wanted me to try to create controlled explosions and fires in order to learn what we were up against. I requested Dave Robertson to help me. Davey was one of the shrewdest, most instinctive engineers I had ever known, with the right flair for these wild experiments. Thank God my wife Faye had no inkling of how I was earning my paycheck in the late autumn of 1959. I remember huddling behind cement barricades with Robertson, trying to create a controlled explosion by rupturing tanks filled with liquid hydrogen under pressure. Nothing happened. The hydrogen just escaped into the atmosphere. So we set a charge and ignited it. Because of its low density, the fireball quickly dissipated. The biggest bang, which knocked us 4 feet backwards, came when we mixed liquid oxygen with an equal amount of liquid hydrogen. The shockwave thudded against a huge hangar under construction about 500 yards away and nearly knocked 4 workers off the scaffolding, while Davy and I huddled out of sight behind the cement wall, giggling like schoolboys. One of our colleagues named our walled-in compound Fort Robertson, because the guy and the place seemed perfectly mated, and the name stuck. We got Dr. Scott of the Bureau of Standards cleared to work with us as an advisor. The Fort Robertson complex was located less than 1,000 yards from the municipal airport's inbound runway. And the first time Dr. Scott paid us a visit and saw the 3 tanks of liquid hydrogen holding hundreds of gallons under storage, his knees began to shake. "My God in heaven," he exclaimed. "You're going to blow up Burbank." Scott came up with a brilliant idea. He suggested we substitute liquid nitrogen, which was less volatile and dangerous than liquid hydrogen, in our experiments as a safer substitute to test what might happen if we used liquid hydrogen under certain conditions. We made about 1,200 gallons of liquid nitrogen. We made a martini in a Dixie cup, then dipped a popsicle stick in the liquid nitrogen and used it to stir the martini. It became a popular taste treat for those cleared to visit us. In less than 3 months, working with 12 skunkworks shop workers and mechanics, we began producing more liquid hydrogen than any other place in the country, about 200 gallons daily. We stored it in a 10-foot-high tank capable of pumping 600 gallons a minute. We wore special grounded shoes and couldn't carry keys or any other metallic objects that might spark. We installed a non-explosive electrical system and used only non-sparking tools. Dave Robertson also invented a special hydrogen leak sniffer around the tanks that would immediately sound a klaxon horn warning that would send us running, probably for our lives. Kelly was pleased with our progress. On the drawing boards was a design for the dart-shaped CL-4.